We are live at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City. I'm Mary Jo Heath. Our Saturday matinee is a heartbreaking bel canto tragedy, Lucia di Lammermoor by Donizetti. Soprano Olga Peretiatko Mariotti and tenor Vittorio Grigolo star as the lovers Lucia and Edgardo. They're joined by Massimo Cavalletti and Vitali Kovalyov, conducted by Gareth Morel, who is replacing Roberto Abbado. During intermission, we'll bring you artist interviews plus the opera quiz with special guest mezzo-soprano Stephanie Blythe. Stay with us.
And we'll be rejoining New York in a moment after their short advertising break. The Metropolitan Opera broadcast season is supported by Toll Brothers, the Annenberg Foundation, the Neubauer Family Foundation and the Vincent A. Stabile Endowment for Broadcast Media, and broadcast here through an arrangement with the European Broadcasting Union. Now we go back to New York for the introduction to Act One of Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor.
I'm Mary Jo Heath, and I'm with our commentator Ira Siff for Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor. It's the most famous and enduring of all the great tragedies written in the bel canto era.
It is indeed. It's been a favorite around the world since its premiere in 1835. You know, here at the Met, it was performed just 2 days after the opening of the house in 1883. It's never really left the repertory.
And Ira, I know it was one of the first operas you ever saw.
Yes, back when I was 15, and it hooked me for life. So many great divas have taken on the title role with its thrilling mad scene. But don't forget, the tenor gets the last word, because the role of Edgardo is also a wonderful vehicle.
Well, Lucia and Edgardo are star-crossed lovers. Their families are mortal enemies. The story, based on a novel by Sir Walter Scott, is set against a backdrop of civil turmoil in Scotland. Here's a synopsis for Act One. The Lammermoor men are searching the castle grounds for an intruder. The head of the clan, Lucia's brother Enrico, fears for their family's future. Their political and financial fortunes are in sharp decline, and Lucia has refused a marriage that could save them. When the chaplain Raimondo responds that it's because she's mourning the recent death of her mother, the captain of the guard blurts out that no, it's because she's in love with Edgardo of Ravenswood. Hearing this, Enrico is beside himself with rage. As the next scene begins, Lucia arrives by a fountain in the park where she'll have a tryst with Edgardo. She tells her companion Elisa about a ghost she once saw by the fountain, a girl who'd been murdered by a jealous lover. When Edgardo comes, he breaks the news that he must depart for France on a political matter. He's willing to make peace with Lucia's brother in order to ask for her hand in marriage. Lucia fears this is impossible. But they exchange rings and pledge their faith to one another before Edgardo leaves as the act ends. So let's go back to the beginning, Ira. There's a somber, brooding overture. And the act begins in the conventional way for bel canto operas, an opening chorus, followed by some recitative that provides exposition, and then a double aria.
Yes, for Enrico, and its driving rhythm immediately conveys his desperation, as well as his anger at Lucia for what he sees as a betrayal of their family. And in the Cabaletta, his rage explodes as he swears vengeance on Edgardo.
Mm-hmm. Well, from this aggressive, highly masculine opening scene, we shift mood with a beautiful prelude to a second scene.
A delicate harp solo sets the tone for Lucia's entrance, and she's the quintessential heroine from that era, dreamy, romantic, and emotionally fragile.
In her aria, she tells the story of the night she saw the ghost, a girl who was slain by one of Edgardo's ancestors.
Now, trills in this aria represent shivers of terror Lucia feels as she relates how the water of the fountain turned blood red.
Elisa is horrified and tries to convince Lucia to give up this dangerous relationship with Edgardo, but Lucia declares that he is her only comfort in life.
And in the Cabaletta, trills become an expression of joy, and scales and soaring high notes illustrate the ecstasy Lucia feels when she's with him.
But when Edgardo arrives, the mood quickly turns dark and anxious. He can't help brooding over the conflict between their families.
The duet intensifies our picture of Lucia caught between two men, her brother and her lover, and we can hear how her tenderness counteracts the storminess of Edgardo's music.
Yeah, their love may have to stay a secret from the world, but they consider themselves united in the eyes of God.
And the duet melts into an exquisite love theme, Verrano a te sul laure, the breezes will carry my sighing to you. And they sing this first individually, then together, and it's so evocative. We'll hear it later in the opera as a recollection of their vows.
Their only happy moment together.
Spoiler
alert, sorry about that. But, you know, enjoy the Act One duet because it is their only happy moment together. We're going to hear in order of vocal appearance Gregory Schmidt as Normanno, Captain of the Guard, Massimo Cavalletti as Enrico, Vitaly Kovalyov as the Chaplain Raimondo, and Olga Peritiatko Mariotti as Lucia. Deborah Nansteel makes her network broadcast debut as Lucia's companion Elisa, and Vittorio Grigolo is Edgardo. The harp solo is performed by Emmanuel Cesson. Our concertmaster today is Benjamin Bowman, and Gareth Morrell, in his network broadcast debut, will be conducting the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra and Chorus. While our production is set in the Victorian era, the show curtain has an image of bare tree branches against a gray sky. When the curtain rises, we're in a rugged, wintry landscape for the scene with the men. There is a frame around that set, and it lifts for the second scene, widening the landscape, and a light snow will start to fall as the harp plays and the lovers meet each other. Here's Gareth Morrell on the podium. Let's hear Act One of Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor.
Splendor, amor, signabile vero, o de mar. destini impallidi la stella. Fermarmi puote nel vacillante mio poter. Lucia, osa respinger quella mano? Oh, suora, non me colai. Volente vergin, che geme sull'or l'argente di cara madre, al collo mo potria volger lo sguardo. Rispettiamo un cuore che trafitto dal duol schivo e d'amore.
Schivo l'amor, Lucia l'amore affanda.
Che favelli
ho detto? Udisse, ella sentia colà che il parco nel suo vino vi ha. Come la madre giace sepolta, impetuoso tuono, ecco su lei s'avventa. Quando per l'aria rimumar si sente un colpo, e al suolo repente cade la belva,
e chi vibrò quel colpo?
Al che il suo nome ricoprì d'un velo,
Lucia forse
l'amò.
Dunque le ridite?
Ogni alba?
E dove?
In quel viale.
Io fremo, né tu scopristi il seduttor.
Sospetto io non soltanto.
Ma parla!
E tuo nemico lo detesti.
Thank you. Thank you. Ragion possente a ciò mi trasse, pria che in ciel biancheggi l'alba novella, dal patrie sponde lungi sarò.
Che dice?
Per franchi di amici sciolgo le vele, il trattarmi dato le sorti della Scozia. Lasciarti, ascolmi vecchia, io stenderò placato a lui la destra.
cari miei, ancor pago non è, mi dolce il cagine, il mio ricacciavito, ne basta, che brava ancor quel cor feroce e rio, la sua perdita intera. Il sangue mio egli m'odia, ma
parla ora c'è qui
restremo fiam ardente in sé mi scorre no.
Sorge una
spite of the hatred between their families, Lucia and Edgardo are bound by their love. That was Act One of Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor, live from the Metropolitan Opera, starring Olga Peretiatko Mariotti as Lucia, Vittorio Grigolo as Edgardo, Massimo Cavalletti as Enrico, and Vitaly Kovalyov as Raimondo, with Gareth Morrell conducting.
You know, I always hear that Verano a Te duet, of course, love, the love duet.
Mm-hmm.
But it always strikes me that it's sort of one of the first operatic leitmotifs I ever knew, because it will, of course, appear again later in the opera. And we associate it so much with the promise that they make between them in secret and dangerously close to what was his family turf that now is her family turf. So there's a lot of danger going on there as well.
A lot of entanglements that can't be unraveled. Yeah. Centuries of hatred going back, don't
yes.
you know?
Yeah.
I'm Mary Jo Heath. Commentator Ira Siff is here with me. And in just a few minutes, we're going to go backstage and speak with our Lucia and Edgardo. Also in this intermission, we'll hear a special interview that our general manager, Peter Gelb, had with our future music director, Yannick Nezet-Séguin. And we'll also hear from mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato, who'll star in the Met premiere of Cendrillon, Massenet's Cinderella opera. Don't go away.
Well, we'll rejoin New York in a couple of minutes after the Met have an advertising break. Act Two of Lucia di Lammermoor is due to start just before 7:30.
Afternoon Concert, weekdays from 2 on BBC Radio 3. This week, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales' 90th anniversary. A week of concerts exploring the orchestra's role in Welsh musical life and beyond, with landmark performances, including the orchestra's first appearance at the BBC Proms. Culminating this Friday with a live performance featuring the music of Welsh composers Bruch and Mozart. This week's afternoon concert from 2 on BBC Radio 3.
Chineke Orchestra's inaugural concert caused a sensation at the Queen Elizabeth Hall in London in the South Bank Centre. That was in 2015, just before the hall closed for refurbishment. On Monday, Europe's first black and minority ethnic orchestra will be back for the Queen Elizabeth Hall's reopening. Their programme includes Beethoven's Joyful Symphony No. 4 and Britten's The Building of the House, the work he chose to conduct at the hall's opening in 1967. You can catch the concert live on Radio 3 at 7:30 on Monday evening. And at 10 to 11 on Monday morning in Essential Classics, the comedian, writer and director and jazz fan Stuart Lee talks about the cultural influences that have inspired and shaped his life and career. And in Music Matters, Tom Service talks to Philip Venables. Well, now we'll rejoin the Met in New York.
Of my instrument.
And now
so well.
A Met cameo.
Puccini knew how to leverage the dramatic potential of my instrument so well.
At the end of Madama Butterfly, as Cho-Cho-San prepares to take her own life, principal timpanist Jason Hoheim is right there.
The timpani are this ostinato, like, doom thunder underneath that. I always love being able to play those dramatic moments.
The timpani can sound tender, too, like in Butterfly's love duet with Pinkerton.
She says, in an ecstasy of love, the sky is smiling. And there I use a stick and an approach and a touch that's just a very round, warm sound. Sounds like an embrace.
There's art and science in Hoheim's playing. As a matter of fact, he used to be a scientist, publishing patents and articles in nanotechnology. But even when he was studying physics and electrical engineering...
Basically, I was like, okay, I can do this, but I don't love it. And I keep finding myself spending all my time practicing and playing music, and that was a big clue.
Now he brings a scientist's curiosity and discipline to musical problems, analyzing how best to practice, interpret a score, or choose a mallet.
They can have different masses, different balances. So you can get hard attacks like kuh sounds or, you know, softer attacks like a muh sort of sound, different sustained tones. And for me, that all helps support the drama.
In the end, Haheim says, science and music make natural partners.
One sort of explores outward in the physical world to understand our place in it, and that's science. And the other explores inward to our sort of emotional world, and that's what music and art do.
Principal timpanist Jason Haheim. With this Met cameo, I'm John Bischoff.
We are live at the Met with Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor. Well, it's the first intermission now, so let's go backstage to where Lauren Toulagin is speaking with Olga Peretiako-Mariotti and Vittorio Grigolo.
Thank you very much, Mary Jo. I am speaking with our Lucia, Olga Peretiako-Mariotti, and our Edgardo, Vittorio Grigolo. Nice to see
Hello,
you both.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, everybody. I have a jingle for you. Good morning, America, live here from the Met.
Yeah, ciao, mama. Ciao, Vittorio. Ciao, house, you see?
You're so shy, Vittorio.
Yeah,
you know,
I am.
You got to get over that. You both sang that last love duet so beautifully. Olga, let me ask you about...
She does it all.
Yeah, she does. Do you ever wish your characters were given more time to be happy together? You know, there's just not much joy in this
opera.
Some
of my characters are happy. Like Adina,
but not
for
Lucia.
Example, and she doesn't,
yeah, but not
doesn't die,
not Lucia.
But not Lucia. It's only one, really, one duet where she's happy. And
right.
It's worse and worse. It's getting worse now. Be prepared.
The melody in that duet flows on and on, the one you just mentioned, yet it sounds so effortless. Vittorio, let me ask you about that. It's just melody after melody after melody, beautiful bel canto. Do you allow yourself the luxury of actually enjoying...
I do allow a lot of luxury to myself. What are you talking
allowing
about?
Allowing that... you know what I mean? Allow just.
I know.
Just
let's be serious. Just, I know what you're talking about.
Just to revel in it? Or are you so just attuned to singing it the right way?
Listening, whenever you have a great partner, whenever you have a great combination with everybody in an amazing cast... It is easy to produce good sounds. You always want to raise your bar. You want to feel the other that is in good shape. So I think that this is the way we always go on stage, trying to be happy with ourselves and always give the best. Of course, in the morning, it's not easy for us, for singers, to be on stage in the morning, so everybody will understand if sometimes something happened, but nothing happened today. It seems like, to me, even better than the evening.
It sounds fabulous.
When did you wake up today?
At 6 o'clock.
At 6? Oh, my God.
Yeah, that's why. That's why.
Oh, my God.
That's why in Italy I called my mom and they said, oh, why you wake up so early? Yes.
Olga, Lucia's music features a lot of rapid coloratura. So what kind of challenge is it to shift between that and the long legato lines?
Well, you know, I'm enjoying so much this now because, you know, the voice is changing and it's really becoming heavier and heavier. And so I really can enjoy the middle register and the middle and the downstairs, I call it always. And what Lucia is about, and I really enjoy these wonderful long lines, and the maestro allows us to do that. So because you know he's breathing with us, and that's the receipt actually. So that's why we could do that so effortless, you know. And yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing music. Just to think about words.
It's so difficult. Also for me, it's not a very easy role. In the beginning, it's very high tessitura, as you said, and but it's very well written. The voice can be warm up right. During the whole show. I could have never did it if I didn't have a good maestro. Actually, I say hello to my teacher in Italy, Danilo Rigosa and Vittorio Selmi. Ciao, belli.
Let me ask you, Vittorio. For most of the rest of the opera,
yeah.
Edgardo believes that Lucia has betrayed him. So. Do you think that ultimately that drives him a little mad, too?
I think, yes. I have to say that I always compare Edgardo as, I would say, he's a Scottish Romeo, you know what I mean? It's like we have to figure it out. We have to understand that this guy has great values. He really loved this girl. He never had the chance to have a physical encounter, I think, deeply, but something, you know, and he really wants to show her this love that is pure energy, is platonic love, but of course he would have, at the end, he would die for her for that, you know, so, I mean, it's very extreme, and I think, yes, I
like
think
like always in opera, and he never gives me the chance to explain what is actually happening.
Right.
Yeah.
Never.
I mean, he betrayed her, but I think at the end, he forget about that. I mean, he is saying, And this moment I'm coming to you, he decided to die for her anyway. So at the end, there is that kind of forgiveness. Mm. We need to be able to forgive.
That's too late, very, too
very
late.
Too late, yeah, but this is a very good key, you know, yeah. To be able to forgive. And I mean, not only in Lucia, we should do it in all our lives, you know, right. It's not easy and simple.
Well, speaking of that, it's so good to see you both sitting here together talking about this and listening to you sing is such a joy. Olga Peretiako, Mariotti, and Vittorio Grigola. Thanks for a few minutes.
Thank you
so much. Remember the jingle. Good morning, America, live here from the Met. That's mine, huh?
I'm Lauren Toulage, and we are live backstage at the Met. And
now it's
Mary
serious.
Jo and I were back to you in the radio booth.
Yes, and now it's serious. Well, that was fun.
Indeed. Well, yeah, as Lauren said, it's a pity he's so withdrawn and so shy, but also so passionate, and that you feel when the artists are passionate, and that passion carries over onto the stage, and that's what it's about, no matter what the style, whether it's bel canto, verismo, it requires. That's one of the bottom lines, after technique and a few other little things.
Have the passion for what you're doing.
Exactly.
You know, I always enjoy talking to Olga. She always has lots to say about her roles, but I'm always surprised when she comes back that her speaking voice is so low and she sings so high. But she did start as a mezzo and then discovered that she was really a coloratura after a while. So, Ira, what a pleasure it was this winter and spring to have Maestro Yannick Nezet-Séguin here leading Wagner's Parsifal and Strauss's Elektra.
Such magnificent performances.
Yeah, they were. And we, along with opera fans across the planet, were thrilled at the news that he'll become the Met's music director next season, 2 years earlier than originally planned. Recently, the Met's general manager, Peter Gelb, sat down to talk with the maestro. Audiences who went to the live and HD transmission of Così fan tutte last week saw part of that interview, and we'd like to share it with our radio audience now, so let's take a listen.
First, can you explain what is the difference between being the music director versus just being a great conductor, which of course you are?
Well, of course, every conductor that gets in front of this wonderful orchestra in this wonderful house with the best cast, the best chorus, is lucky to pursue the goal of excellence. Of course, as a guest conductor, we know we step into a certain tradition, a certain level that has been nurtured for years in this opera house. And the difference when there is the responsibility of being the music director is to be the one responsible for keeping that quality. But to keep a certain quality also means to go further. Because, as we all know, I mean, it's the principle of life, and of course certainly of management, but everything in life philosophically, that if you want to stay at the best of your capacities, you have to strive for better.
What are some of the specific things that you're going to be working on, or have already started working on?
It goes from, in rehearsal, having a certain different kind of work. For example, talking about this season, you know, the Wagner style and the Strauss style, and actually enabling the musicians to remember when we see on a page and we play that composer, when we see that sign or that indication, what does it mean? What is the main value? And those values need always to be reassessed together so that when there is also a guest conductor, of course, the guest conductor can still ask for something different, but there is sort of a, by default, a set of values musically that the orchestra can remember and do all year long. Connected to this, there are some specifics, for example, about bowings in the strings. We're in a pit, so we're not seen, and therefore the bowings don't necessarily always need to be exactly the same if we want to achieve a different effect in the music. So that's one of the examples of the detail. But that also has to do with a much larger thing, which is being responsible for personnel. There is a personnel manager here at the Met, of the orchestra, of course, but I need to work as a team with this person so that we're sure to have the right auditions. Also, once someone wins an audition at the Met, I've started already to make comments and try to give feedback to the younger musicians so that they can eventually get tenured. And that is really only the orchestra. And of course, we're artistic partners, you and I, has to program the season and also imagine new projects together. So that is, of course, very different than a guest conductor can do.
Of course. You know, all the great conductors in history have had their own special trademarks or techniques. You know, when you think of Toscanini, who once was the conductor of the Met Orchestra,
yeah.
He conducted not only with his stick, but with his eyes.
Yeah.
if you were just to describe your technique, what is the trademark of Yannick Nézet-Séguin's conducting technique?
Maybe that's the most difficult question for a conductor to answer. But what I can say is what has been taught to me, especially by Maestro Giulini, with whom I worked for a year. The most important thing for the so-called clarity of a conductor is that it's clear in the mind. The minute you're thinking, oh, I'm going to do that gesture, the thinking makes it unclear. Another way of saying it is, I feel I need to embody the music. I need to be the music at that given moment. It's not anymore about the tip of the stick, or it's not anymore about how high my arm is. It's all about just be exactly emotionally and expressively in the moment. Of course, while not losing sight of that clarity, but I think if I know that the chord will be there, I'm not second-guessing myself. I'm not even questioning it. It will be there. I mean, I know it sounds simple, and it's not as simple.
No, it doesn't sound simple at all. But at what point in your career did you reach the moment where you could do that?
Well, I wanted to say, do we ever reach it? Every time I come back, even within a run of performances here at the Met, we all, and I certainly do, try to be better than the previous time and try to make things better and more true to the score and true to my conception without trying to impose it. Also, something I talk with the musicians very often is to be so much in the moment that you're able to embrace whoever is on stage, or even if it's the same cast, things are different from
every night a singer's
exactly.
Feeling different, and you have to be able to go with them.
I used to make the mistake a little bit of trying to shake that a little bit, or trying to shake off the routine just for the sake of it. If you're just in the moment, then by definition it won't be routine. But to answer your question, I think there was never a definite moment, but what I know is that I feel strongly that at this moment I am experienced enough, both in symphonic and in opera repertoire, to be able to serve our house the best I could with my capacities. If it had been 10 years ago, I wouldn't have had this experience and this confidence. And now I'm still not too old. I can give all my energy to it.
We all feel it too. I mean, I certainly feel it. And I know the members of the orchestra and the chorus and the singers on the stage, everyone feels that. So it's a very exciting time. And I really appreciate talking to you and having a chance for our audiences to get a sense of what you're thinking about as you're taking over the Met's music directorship. So thank you so much.
It's a great pleasure, Peter, and I can't wait to see all our audiences around the world in next season.
That was Maestro Yannick Nézet-Séguin. He spoke with Peter Gelb recently, our general manager. The maestro will be leading three operas for us next season, Verdi's La Traviata, in a new production, Debussy's Pelléas et Mélisande, and Poulenc's Dialogues of the Carmelites.
You know, it's striking what a wonderful range of repertoire he's led here already in less than a decade.
Less than a decade. It's really hard for me to believe that, yes, it was only 2009 that he made his Met debut, and the whole company promptly fell in love with him. Well, speaking of falling in love, Massenet-Cendrillon is making its Met debut on Thursday, the company's first ever presentation of this enchanting opera. Mezzo-soprano Joyce DiDonato stars as Cinderella, opposite mezzo-soprano Alice Coote as Prince Charming. DiDonato has triumphed in this opera in the acclaimed production by Laurent Pelly in a few different international houses over the last dozen years. I chatted with her recently and asked her what she finds so special about it.
You know, each time I come back to it, I'm more dazzled and moved by it. There is a kind of purity and an innocence about it, which is very hard to accomplish, I think, in opera. A real sort of naivete. And yet at the same time, it's immensely humorous and it's deeply emotional. We've been in the rehearsals in Alice Coote, who's singing My Prince Charming, my mm-hmm. Prince Charmant, and Laurent and all. We were in tears as we were running through the piece. The sort of ambience in the world right now is quite intense. And when you're hit out of the blue with this ray of light, it takes you by surprise, and somehow it seems brighter than ever. And I just can't imagine a more perfect moment for this piece to be coming to this theater.
Hmm. Well, we all kind of know the Cinderella story. I think in this country especially, we know the Disney version of it. So tell us about the opera's take on this fairy tale, because there are a few differences.
It starts very much in the Disney world. You know, there's the sort of over-the-top stepmother and the crazy sisters who are dressed impeccably, and the sort of long-suffering father who regrets what he's done and loves his daughter so much. And it goes quite well. The ball is, just everybody needs to see this because you've never seen anything like this on this stage. But then when we go to the third act, very similar to Werther, where it turns into this, we go quite into a dark world, becomes almost Wagnerian. And Cendrillon is so upset at losing the prince and thinking that he doesn't understand that she really loved him, she decides she wants to commit suicide. And she runs into the enchanted forest to kill herself. At the same time, the prince is there, ready to hang his cœur sanglant, his bloody heart, onto the branch of a particular tree. In our production, the forest is the chimney rooftops of Paris. And it's just so beautiful. But they both are really ready to end their lives. And we hear it in the music, and it takes this kind of urgency that certainly Disney didn't quite go in that direction.
No,
we come back and we finish, you know, the glass slipper fits and everything is wonderful, but we get some real meat and profundity in that third act.
You mentioned Alice Coote. Prince Charming is also a mezzo. So what opportunities does that give the two of you in the duets with these two mezzos?
I love it. Well, this is a funny score because in our case, we have two mezzos. Sometimes the Prince Charmant is referred to as a soprano falcon, which is a bit more dramatic. Many sopranos have sung Cendrillon as well, lighter-voiced sopranos. They're very interchangeable in different ways. Mm-hmm. What is so lovely is Alice and I, our timbres are really distinct, and I think that's important. If you had two very similar-sounding mezzos, it wouldn't work in this.
Kind of helps us on the radio, too.
Ah, good. Yeah. But it's also, there's two stunning duets. The second duet turns into a trio as well. And I just think you hear that it becomes very sensual because you have these two female voices that are distinct and yet also intertwine. And sometimes you lose track of who is who. Yeah, it's incredibly sensual, which this music should be, mm-hmm. with the, you know, the rainbow of innocence around it, but it's all in there, yeah.
You mentioned a few things about the Pelli production. Clearly, it really resonates with you.
It is as perfect a production as I've ever been a part of. When he was a child, his grandmother used to read to him from the original Perrault, and it was this huge red leather-bound book full of illustrations and pictures. And I think it made such a huge impression on him. He's literally brought that book to life. Everything is really as if it's leaping off the page through the imagination of Laurent.
That was Joyce DiDonato, our Cinderella, the title character in Massenet's Cendrillon, which has its Met premiere on Thursday. In addition to Alice Coote, the opera also stars Stephanie Blythe. We'll hear from her later this broadcast as our quiz guest. Kathleen Kim and Laurent Nauri, conducted by Bertrand de Billy.
You know, Mary Jo, this piece, which a lot of people don't know, they really should. It's an extraordinary piece because, as Joyce was saying, it walks the line between being hilarious and then so surprisingly moving. The music runs the gamut from homage to Rameau to Wagnerian sounds, all with Massenet's own signature. And Stephanie, as the stepmother, has to be seen and heard. This is a great cast, and I love the production.
Cendrillon will be our broadcast in 3 weeks on April the 28th, when it will also be shown in movie theaters live in HD.
And we'll be back at the Met very soon.
BBC Radio 3 presents new programmes for your weekend. Music Planet.
A new look, a new sound, a new feel.
Inside Music.
His facility is completely without any limits.
J to Z.
The best in jazz, past, present and future.
And a new time for drama on 3.
Well, let's empty a glass to the old huntsman.
Ah, yeah.
Starting with a classic play by Henrik Ibsen, The Wild Duck, tomorrow evening at 7:30.
Everything will be all right now, Gregus.
To find out more about the changes, go to our schedule on the Radio 3 website.
Coming up soon, Act 2 of Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor. Here's a preview of next Saturday's matinee broadcast, live from the stage of the Metropolitan Opera. Louisa Miller, Verdi's gripping tragedy about steadfast love in the face of deceit and intrigue. Sonia Yontova is Louisa, an ordinary girl forced to make unbearable sacrifices for her lover and for her father. Piotr Bachawa is Rodolfo, defying all in his passion for Louisa. And Placido Domingo is her father, Miller, whose devotion to his daughter makes them a target for evil. Maestro Bertrand de Billy leads the Met Chorus and Orchestra in this beautiful epitome of Verdi's humanity. Louisa Miller, live from the Met, next Saturday's broadcast. We are live at the Metropolitan Opera with Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor. I'm Mary Jo Heath, commentator Ira Siff is here with me, and Act 2 will begin in a few minutes. As we remember at the end of Act 1, Edgardo left Scotland for France to deal with a political matter. But first, he and Lucia swore to be true to each other, and he pledged his faith with a ring. So, Ira, let's talk through the story and music for Act 2, which takes place at the Lammermoor Castle. Edgardo has been gone for months, and we learn that Lucia's brother Enrico and his henchmen have secretly been intercepting all the letters between the lovers. Enrico is desperate for his sister to marry the powerful Lord Arturo Bucklaw, which will save their family from ruin. The wedding has already been arranged. The groom is on his way. The only obstacle is Lucia herself.
And we can hear the tension between brother and sister in the music introducing their duet. Lucia breaks her silence with an outburst as she accuses him of inhuman cruelty. And he hurls the same fiery melody back at her, trying to take on a self-righteous tone.
But then he resorts to outright trickery. He presents her with a forged letter, which supposedly proves Edgardo is in love with another woman. Lucia reads it and is utterly devastated.
And she dissolves into an exquisite, tearful mini-aria within their duet, expressing her heartbreak. And on the heels of this terrible blow, a fanfare is heard announcing Arturo's arrival.
But Lucia continues to resist the marriage, and Enrico explodes. He warns Lucia that by refusing this alliance, she's delivering him to the executioner's axe, and his ghost will haunt her for what she's done. Once Enrico leaves, the family chaplain Raimondo comes to Lucia. He is sympathetic to her plight, but he too has been duped into believing that Edgardo has betrayed her. and he urges Lucia to agree to the arranged marriage and save her family.
You know, this duet used to be cut ostensibly to tighten the drama, but it's crucial to the drama. Raimondo is someone Lucia trusts, and that's what leads her to give in.
Arturo arrives to a warm welcome from the whole castle. Lucia, overwhelmed by her heartbreak, no longer has the strength to resist the pressure. But no sooner has she signed the fateful marriage contract than Edgardo bursts in.
And out of the stunned silence that falls over everyone, we hear the arpeggio that launches the famous sextet. And this is one of those great Donizetti ensembles in which time is suspended. A single shared melody carries all the various emotions of each character.
Yes, Lucia's distress stops Edgardo's rage in its tracks and moves Enrico to remorse. As for her, she can only wish for death. Once the sextet ends, the action moves back into real time. Raimondo has to invoke his religious authority to keep violence from breaking out. But when Edgardo learns that Lucia has married Arturo, there's no stopping him. He tears the ring from her finger and curses the day he fell in love with her.
With this, Edgardo launches the stretta, the rapid, driven ensemble for the full company, interweaving melodies for solo voices and chorus, and it's a thrilling contrast to the suspended feeling of the sextet.
Edgardo storms out, leaving Lucia shattered, and that's how the act ends. And in fact, when the curtain comes down, she is in front of the curtain and everybody else is behind it as if she's already separate in some way. In Act Two, in order of vocal appearance, we'll hear Gregory Schmidt as Normanno, the captain of the guard, Massimo Cavalletti as Enrico, and Olga Peritiatko-Mariotti as Lucia. Vitali Kovalyov is Raimondo, Mario Chang is Lucia's bridegroom Arturo, Deborah Nansteel is Elisa, and Vittorio Grigolo is Edgardo. Gareth Morrell conducts the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra and chorus. Well, the set for this act is a room in the Lammermoor Castle, and at first it hints at the family's reduced fortunes, their drooping curtains, sheets covering the furniture and chandeliers. But gradually the servants will come in and transform it into a wedding scene, uncovering everything and decorate it, and it will look very respectable and festive. Here's Gareth Morrell. Let's hear Act Two of Lucia di Lammermoor.
Lucia fra poco a te verrà, tremante l'aspetto. A festeggiar le nozze illustri, già nel castello i nobili parenti giunser di mia famiglia. In breve Arturo qui volge, e se la pertinace osasse d'opporsi, non temer,
La lunga assenza del tuo nemico, i fogli da noi rapiti, e la bugiarda nuova, che gli s'accese d'altra fiamma. In cuore di Lucia spegneranno il cieco amore. Ella s'avanza, il simulato foglio porgimi, ed essi sulla via che tragge alla città regina di Scozia. E qui fra applausi e liete grida conduce Arturo. Appressati, Lucia. Sperai più lieta in questo dì vederti, in questo dì che di Meneo le faci s'accendono per te. Mi guardi e taci. Vincerò amore,
Dal precipizio al tuo posso trarmi solo. lasciarmi.
L'ultimo raggio tramontò, credei al tuo sospetto che fratel chiudesse tutte le strade, onde sul franco suolo all'uom che amar giurasti non giungesser tue nuove. Io stesso un foglio da te vergato per sicura mano reca li feci. Fano, tace mai sempre quel silenzio assai d'infedeltà ti parla.
Ne condiserò
di fidarti al destino.
Ma che giuramento?
Tu pur vaneggi le voti che il ministro di Dio non benedice, nel ciel, nel mondo riconosce.
Oh,
Oh!
Edgardo, unaware that Lucia was tricked and forced to marry another man, has cursed her for betraying their love. That was very exciting.
Yes,
that was
indeed.
Act Two of Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor, live from the Metropolitan Opera. We heard Olga Peritiatko-Mariotti as Lucia, Vittorio Grigolo as Edgardo, Massimo Cavaletti as Enrico, and Vitaly Kovalyov as Raimondo. Gareth Morrell is conducting the performance. Ira.
Yeah, it's quite a fiery thing. And so what, for, you know, we were talking about how after the suspension of the sextet, that seems to, in relief, make the Stretta even more exciting. After suspending it, everything explodes. And one of the things we have now that we didn't have in my day is the cuts that were taken in that Stretta are...
Opened back up.
Mm-hmm. And Donizetti really knew what he was doing in building that climax. And the layers of vocal music and orchestration is really quite exciting, something quite exciting.
And we should tell our radio listeners that Edgardo was, he grabbed a sword from one of the soldiers, he pointed at himself and kind of gave the handle of it to Lucia, like, okay, I'm ready to die now, knowing that you've married another man, just kill me now, that's all I want. He was furious and running around and finally dashed out at the end, and she sort of collapsed and was on the other side of the curtain.
High romantic drama, really.
Drama. I'm Mary Jo Heath, our commentator is Ira Siff. In this intermission, mezzo-soprano Stephanie Blythe will be our guest on the Opera Quiz. And we'll learn a little bit more, a little bit to begin with, actually, about the wonderful and unusual musical instrument that will be featured in Lucia's famous Mad Scene. The Toll Brothers Metropolitan Opera Quiz will begin in just a few minutes. Don't go away.
Afternoon Concert, weekdays from 2 on BBC Radio 3. This week, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales' 90th anniversary. A week of concerts exploring the orchestra's role in Welsh musical life and beyond, with landmark performances, including the orchestra's first appearance at the BBC Proms. Culminating this Friday with a live performance featuring the music of Welsh composers Bruch and Mozart. This week's Afternoon Concert from 2 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, coming up in this interval is the Met Quiz. The questions for the quiz are entirely supplied by listeners from all over the world. It's well worth submitting one, because if yours is chosen, then you'll earn yourself a gift package of opera recordings and publications. Here's the address to write to. Metropolitan Opera Quiz, Metropolitan Opera, 30 Lincoln Center, New York, New York, 10023 in the United States of America. Metropolitan Opera Quiz, Metropolitan Opera, 30 Lincoln Center, New York, New York, 10023. Please do remember to mention that you hear the broadcasts on BBC Radio 3. And in fact, one of our listeners has a question being answered this very day. You can also submit questions online at the Radio 3 website, and while you're there, have a browse through the Opera on 3 pages. The schedule of upcoming Met broadcasts is there, along with details of Radio 3's live and recorded broadcasts from the British opera houses. And from there, you can also find links to the Met's own website, where there are further details about the operas, including synopses and casting information. The Met's website is also the place to go if you'd like to find out what's planned for this season and next. Well, it's very nearly time to return to the Met for one of their breakaway features.
What happens when people encounter ghosts in opera? I'm William Berger at the Met with some examples. Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov is haunted by a victim of his ambition. So is Verdi's Macbeth. And Oreste in Gluck's Iphigenie en Tauride has a vision of his mother whom he murdered. The voice of Antonia's dead mother encourages her to sing herself to death in Offenbach's Le Comte Hoffmann. While the ghost of the old countess gives fatal advice to Hermann in Tchaikovsky's The Queen of Spades. In her famous mad scene, Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor is terrified by a phantom. And the Norwegian sailors flee from the ghostly crew of the Flying Dutchman in Wagner's opera. These are just a few of the many memorable apparitions in opera.
We're live at the Met, where we're listening to Lucia di Lammermoor by Gaetano Donizetti, with a libretto by Salvatore Camerano, based on Sir Walter Scott's novel, The Bride of Lammermoor. This production is by Mary Zimmerman, sets by Daniel Osling, costumes by Mara Blumenfeld, lighting is by T.J. Gerkens, and the choreography by Daniel Pelsig. The production is a gift of the Sybil B. Harrington Endowment Fund. The revival is a gift of the Metropolitan Opera Club. The chorus master is Donald Palumbo. Musical preparation is by Gareth Morell, Thomas Bagwell, Joshua Green, Carol Isaac, and Leora Maurer. The assistant stage directors are Sarah Ina Myers and Daniel Ragazzi. The stage band conductor is Gregory Buchalter and the prompter, Carol Isaac. The Italian coach is Hemdi Kafir, and the stage manager is Gary Dietrich. Well, it's the second intermission now, and that means it's time for the opera quiz. Our panelists are Corey Ellison, a dramaturg who's on the vocal arts faculty at Juilliard, Suzanne Martinucci, a former Met assistant chief usher, and conductor Willie Anthony Waters, assistant professor of music at Binghamton University. Our host today is voice teacher and vocal consultant Gerald Martin Moore. Are y'all ready down there? So let's go to List Hall.
Hello, good afternoon, and welcome to our enthusiastic audience in List Hall and radio listeners across the globe. Our first question comes from Paul Maloney of Glasgow, Scotland, my home country. I don't affect this voice, it's my real voice, it's my comedy voice. So land of my birth, O patria mia, or patria oppressa, depending on your viewpoint. He listens to us on Radio 3, and Mr. Maloney is interested in unusual instruments featured prominently in opera, such as the glass harmonica we'll hear during Lucia's mad scene in the next act. We've turned this into a show and tell and asked our panelists to bring in favourite examples. So, Corey, we'll start with you. Tell us about your clip and why you chose it.
Well, I chose the aria Non più di fiori from La Clemenza di Tito by Mozart, which features the basset horn, which is nowadays a very unusual instrument, but very, very popular during Mozart's time. It's a single reed instrument pitched in F, and it's kind of between, a member of the clarinet family, between the soprano clarinets and the bass clarinet, and it has a darker, richer tone and a range of four octaves that goes down lower. Brahms wrote in a letter to Clara Schumann that he felt that this instrument, no other instrument blended better with the human voice. And E.T.A. Hoffmann described the sound of it as being like red carnations. So the reason I chose it, besides the fact that it's a beautiful aria and a very interesting instrument, is that this is a real... I think an unusual example of an aria that's written as much with the instrumental soloist in mind, the particular person for whom it was written, Anton Stadler, who was the greatest clarinet virtuoso of the time in Vienna, a member of the court orchestra, and a really good friend of Mozart's, though he was supposedly kind of a jerk and a lot of people didn't like him. But Mozart and Stadler are really responsible for, more than anyone, for the clarinet being accepted into the symphony orchestra. And here in this aria, it's set up as kind of, it works different ways. They're in dialogue.
Sorry to cut you off, Corey, because okay. We're sort of, okay. let's hear it and then okay. We can discuss. Okay.
All right.
Rob, can we have the clip, please?
Oh.
So there we are.
Well, there, what I was about to say is that sometimes they're sort of in dialogue like this, that one speaks and then the other speaks, and then sometimes they're intertwined. Sure. So it's very interesting. It's actually the first piece that was written for Clemenza di Tito is actually known to have been performed in April of 1791, where the opera itself wasn't premiered until September. So it's the very first piece that Mozart wrote for it.
Inches, that's great information. Thank you, Corey. Willie, what about your choice?
I chose the aria Valle Scule Milarme from Massenet's Werther, the alto saxophone. I think it was probably the first time a saxophone was used in an operatic orchestra. Corey could probably tell me if that's right or not. But it's a very interesting sound. We know the alto saxophone, of course, mostly from jazz and maybe some Gershwin performances and such things. But it's the introduction, and it accompanies the aria. And I think it adds a very somber, sort of sad, melancholy type of air to the aria. So that's why I chose it.
Okay, Rob, let's hear the clip, please. Suzanne, can we have your choice, please?
Sure. I chose the upright, out-of-tune piano that Alban Berg asks for in Wozzeck. And this is used at the beginning of Act 3, Scene 3. It's right after Wozzeck has murdered Marie. And there's a brief interlude where you just hear the note B. It almost sounds like a fire alarm. In crescendos to this unbelievable volume, and then you go right into this tavern where someone's just sort of banging out music on this out-of-tune piano while Wozzeck is trying to sing a bawdy song and probably forget what he's just done. And one reason I like this example is that the piano being out of tune, it's sort of a sign of truth, because this run-down tavern, nobody really called Beethoven pianos every once in a while to have it tuned. And also because it kind of underlines the kind of desperation that these poor people are exhibiting and trying to dance and drink and forget their problems. And I also figured that, no two pianos can be out of tune in exactly the same way. So every time you do Wozzeck, it's a different sound.
Well, there's a challenge. Rob, can we hear that excerpt, please? So now let's hear some music on a hopefully in-tune piano played by Met assistant conductor Howard Watkins. About 20 minutes ago, Edgardo burst into Lucia's wedding festivities and caused a great shock among the guests. Now Maestro Watkins is about to play other operatic reactions to the arrival of unexpected guests. Panelists, you tell us the opera and the situation. Ready? Maestro.
I think that's the end of Act One of Rigoletto. Monterone, the entrance, he sure knows how to ruin a party.
Monterone arriving at the end of Verdi's Rigoletto, first scene of Act One. Number two, Maestro. Suzanne had your hand up first.
That's the knock at the door, and it's Benoit, the landlord in the first act of Puccini's La Bohème. The friends are about to go out and celebrate Christmas Eve. They've got money, and all of a sudden they realize he's coming to get the rent.
Correct. Number three. Willie.
That's Mozart's Don Giovanni, the graveyard scene with the Commendatore, and is confronting Giovanni.
He's turning up for dinner.
Right.
Invited, but not entirely expected. Yes. Howard, number four, please.
I believe that's the arrival of Bacchus in Ariadne auf Naxos.
You've got the right composer for the opera,
okay.
Suzanne.
This is the final act of Rosenkavalier when the Marschallin arrives in the inn.
Shows up in Act 3 and catches everyone in flagrante. Correct. That's the right answer. Okay. So now it's my pleasure to introduce a mezzo-soprano who has been one of the Met's most beloved singers ever since her debut in 1995. She's starring as Madame de l'Altière in the Met's first ever presentation of Cendrillon, Massenet's Cinderella opera, which opens on Thursday. Please help me welcome Stephanie Blythe. Stephanie, you always seem to be having to come to the defense of these vilified characters you play. So, do you have anything to say on behalf of the wicked stepmother?
No.
Well, that was succinct.
I think that if I try to defend the wicked stepmother, it seriously changes the show. Mm. So let's just say she's truly bad.
Look forward to that.
I love playing a just plain old evil person. It's good.
Okay, so stepmothers and mothers-in-law find themselves in some odd positions in opera. And that's the theme of our presto round, which Stephanie is going to help us with.
I'll describe an operatic stepmother or mother-in-law, or a prospective one, and you tell me who she is. Ready with your bells?
Number one, Stephanie.
This noble lady spends the first act of the opera thinking she's going to marry a man, only to have him become her stepson.
Suzanne.
Oh, is this Oedipus Rex of Stravinsky?
It's not, I'm afraid.
Sorry.
Any other? Verdi opera?
Could you get the clue again?
This noble lady spends the first act of the opera thinking she's going to marry a man, only to have him become her stepson.
Oh.
Really?
Don Carlo, yes.
Elizabeth in Verdi's Don Carlo. Correct. Stephanie, number two, please.
This woman spends the first couple acts of the opera trying to marry a man, only to learn he's actually her son.
Corey.
That's Marcellina in Le Nozze di Figaro. Figaro is her son.
Correct. Stephanie, number three.
This formidable character doesn't get along with her stepdaughter. Well, see how you'd feel if your husband had 9 daughters with someone else, not to mention twins with yet another woman.
Corey.
That's Fricka in The Ring.
You better believe it. I will defend her. That's right.
Yeah. Number four.
Another formidable character. She sends a prospective son-in-law on a crazy adventure with a musical instrument to protect him.
Suzanne.
That's the Queen of the Night in Mozart's Magic Flute. She sends...
Correct.
Yes.
Number five, Stephanie.
This woman is willing to commit murder in order to protect her stepdaughter's future.
Corey.
That's Kostelnička in Yennefer.
Janáček's Yennefer. Yeah. Correct. Stephanie, number six, please.
Here's a stepmother who's so overbearing that her own son is ready to run off and join the circus. Literally.
Suzanne.
This is Smetana's The Bartered Bride, and the son is Vashek.
And the woman is?
Oh, gosh. Uh-huh. No, that's not her name.
Hatta?
Correct.
Hatta.
Bonus point to Cordy. Number seven, Stephanie.
This girl is too busy staring at a light to notice that her little stepson is spying on her.
Oh, no.
Suzanne.
This is Debussy's Pelléas and Mélisande, and the boy is Ignold.
And the, yes.
Mélisande. And Mélisande is...
Most sopranos are usually busy staring at a light. Oh, number eight, Stephanie.
I'm a mezzo, I'm not a
I know that. That's why I was able to make that joke today. Number eight.
This lady is willing to raise her husband's little son as her own, even though he's trouble.
Willie.
Everybody got that one, I guess. That's Madame Butterfly.
And the woman is?
Oh, the woman is Butterfly.
No.
Oh.
Kate Pinkerton.
Right. Kate.
Second wife of Pinkerton.
So that was a tie with an edge to Cody for the bonus points. Well done. So, Stephanie, you have a knack for reaching audiences in a very memorable way, both in your operatic roles and beyond. And that connection is something you've talked about. So let's have a discussion about what we think connects with audiences today. For example, everyone's always talking about audience outreach. Stephanie, what are some ways that you see opera singers best reaching audiences today without necessarily apologizing for the art form that we love?
I think that the best, the singers who do this in the best way utilize all the things that we have today in order to reach our audiences, meaning social media. I think that when we utilize this in the right way, it can be really something. But the basic idea is that singers need to know how to talk about the art form. We spend a lot of time, as we should, learning how to hone our craft and become the best singers that we can. But it's also very important for us to be able to articulate why we are passionate about singing and what it means to sing particular roles and how we go about singing them. And when we do that, we open a window to our audiences and they become more curious about the art form. Don't you all want to know about what makes singers do what they do and how they do what they do? It becomes a much more, when we invite our audiences in that way, so that we are connecting with them through the art form and not in the way that we, in more popular art forms, we become connected to our audiences because, you know, we tell everybody, you know, they eat Cheerios for breakfast, and what kind of clothing they're wearing. For us, our audiences are really, really drawn to the art form first. So if we connect through opera to our audiences, it becomes more palpable and it becomes more visceral. And I think that one of the things that I'm trying to do with the singers that I work with today is to encourage them to learn how to speak and how to find the vocabulary to make that connection.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So panelists, we have a panelist of educators, professionals, and fans. What are your views on this subject? Suzanne.
Well, frankly, that's an aspect that I'd never thought about before. I'd always heard, you know, that, well, opera's difficult because it's in a different language and we can't really identify with that. But I don't think that's really true. I think if you look at the people performing opera today, you see all races and cultures. I mean, obviously, the music speaks to them. Sometimes I worry about the attention spans of young audiences. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe, Ms. Blythe, you have the point. If singers themselves can explain to young people or new audiences why they do what they do, why they're passionate about this art form, make a personal connection with them, maybe that's the key.
Willie?
It's been done, actually, by many opera companies over the years. And I think one of the most important things is to get the singers in front of the students. I mean, whether it's in a classroom situation or most opera companies, for example, have educational programs that go to the schools. And they incorporate into that afterwards a Q&A in which the singers actually come out, whether in costume or not, and actually talk to the students. And they can do exactly as Stephanie has said, you know, let them know why they're passionate about the art form and what it's all about. And also the kids then have a direct connection to them so that they don't feel that they're, you know, mythological characters and that they're unapproachable.
Exactly. Cordy.
Well, this is sort of another end of things that I've come to believe in the last few years when so much of my work has been in helping to develop new operas. And I'm finding that we seem to be able to draw whole new audiences who then might come back to see more standard repertory by creating new operas in our own language, often with stories that are directly resonant to events or themes of today. And I think that's another great way of opening out the art form.
Indeed. And Suzanne, you mentioned social media and attention spans. So we often hear that things like smartphones have changed the pace of people's lives. What does this mean for opera? Like, Stephanie, you must encounter this all the time now with people using cell phones. And what do you think the implications are for this that could be positive?
I'm changing the way I look at social media. Mm-hmm. I joined Twitter. I can't believe it. I promise. I never do it. But I actually did it. I'm an avid Facebook user. I use Instagram. And I was very much against this. And I changed my mind for this reason. There's nothing that we can do to stop this innovation. Nothing. Mm-hmm. It is going to happen. If we do not embrace it and find a way to use it positively for ourselves, we're kidding ourselves. And I think that it's entirely possible to make connections with our audiences that way. I know this is going to sound really silly, but I learned how to play the ukulele 2 years ago. And I have made about 10 ukulele videos, which I've put on my public page and my private page. And I have made connections with audiences that have nothing to do with opera, who are shocked to find out that I'm an opera singer, in fact. And it's very, very enjoyable for them.
Fantastic. So those chimes tell us that it's time to get back to Lucia de Lammermoor and see how the newlyweds are faring. No spoilers. So before I return you to Mary Jo and Ira in the radio booth, I'd like to thank our panellists, Corey Ellison, Suzanne Martinucci and Willie Anthony Waters. Special thanks to Howard Watkins too, and particularly our delightful guest, Stephanie Blythe.
Thank you, Gerald. That was Gerald Martin Moore with the Opera Quiz down in List Hall.
You know, it's wonderful inspiration to hear people talk about this. It's on all of our minds, how to embrace social media and use it for opera, how to bring opera to people who would not otherwise embrace it. And that's wonderful to hear all these different points of view.
If you haven't seen Stephanie Blythe's videos of her playing the ukulele and singing a whole host of different kind of songs, you've missed out, because it's really, really wonderful. So just go find them. They're out there and they're lots of fun. She's great. Well, in just a little while, as they mentioned a minute ago, the final act of Lucia de Lammermoor will begin, the act in which we get to hear Lucia's famous mad scene. And of course, it's a big showcase for the soprano, but also for the glass harmonica, something we heard Gerald mention during the quiz.
You're right. That's how Donizetti originally wrote it, though we do most often still hear the version with the flute.
Here at the Met in some past seasons, we've heard it performed with the glass harmonica. It's a hypnotically beautiful sound.
Yeah, it's particularly striking during the cadenza toward the end of the mad scene. It's basically an unaccompanied duet with soprano.
Yes, just the two of them. Well, the instrument we've heard before was the model invented by none other than Benjamin Franklin, a group of tuned crystal bowls on their sides and nestled around a rotating spindle. But today, we're going to hear an updated version of it called a verophone. Mm. And Ira, this is not your founding father's glass harmonica. It's louder, it has a bigger range, and it can fly like the wind during those fast runs and arpeggios. Recently, I slipped downstairs to a practice room to meet our verophone player, Friedrich Heinrich Kern, or Fritz, and see the instrument up close and personal. That's really cool, guys. So this is a very sophisticated version of when we're all sitting in a bar and we dip our finger in a wine glass and go around the edge.
Essentially, that's correct.
Taken to the highest degree of artistry.
The problem is if your hands are greasy or if you shake hands with someone or if you sweat. So I wash my hands with a certain soap, dry them, and then I use water that I select in advance. Usually in an opera house, I select the sink that has good water.
The verophone is three rows of clear glass tubes suspended vertically from longest to shortest in a wooden frame as high as a marimba or a xylophone. Cairn dips his fingers in a bowl of water and rubs them around the glass rims.
It's a total of 2.5 octaves, and there are always three chromatic tones behind each other. That has the big advantage that I can play chords with my hands.
In performance, Karen controls dynamics, tone, and articulation by changing the pressure and the speed of his fingers on the glass. He can also adapt the instrument for different effects. It looks like glass organ pipes, in a way. And then off to the side, it looks like cocktail hour over there.
I brought an extension set. They're finely tuned crystal glasses that have a very brilliant sound, and they extend the verophone for a few notes. That allows me to play the high notes in the cadenza with Lucia.
Great, because I didn't dream that you could be so virtuosic on this thing.
Yeah, this part is very tricky. The problem is also that I have so much time to wait, you know, because I'm only at the mat scene. I have to be on point right there, and that is particularly a problem with the high notes, because they're so hard with the attack. Mm-hmm. So if you don't prepare your hands in time, you won't get the notes.
Lucia's Mad Scene may be the glass harmonica's greatest claim to fame. Mozart and Beethoven also wrote for the instrument, but Donizetti was clearly inspired by its dramatic possibilities. Even though he also scored the part for flute, that may have been for purely practical reasons.
There are not that many glass harmonicas on this planet, and there's many Lucia performances. Even back then, it was a very popular opera. I'm biased, I would think, but I feel the glass harmonica reflects her madness or her going in and out of consciousness and her despair, all these feelings, and this magical moment is reflected in this ethereal sound.
That's Friedrich Heinrich Cern, who's one of the few people in the world who play this type of verophone.
You know, it's fascinating because we all know that Donizetti really wanted this and for pragmatic reasons went with the flute, which is also has a haunting feeling. But this is so much eerier. But with the traditional glass harmonica in a house the size of the Met particularly, it could be difficult to really get the full effect of that eeriness. And here this instrument is so present.
And it projects all the way into the house. You can hear it all over the place. And like I said, he can just play everything right along with her.
Extraordinary.
I wanted to mention that Olga Petitiaco-Mariotti puts an unusual stamp on the cadenza. Sopranos traditionally quote that love theme, but she also quotes a couple other melodies. And Cern told me that he had her record them into his phone so he could work out an accompaniment. So you can picture the two of them. She's singing, he's got his phone recording, and then he goes away and figures it out.
In the 19th century colliding with the 21st century.
That's great. We even skipped the 20th altogether. Well,
I'm just looking so forward to hearing it. It's coming up.
Me too. I'm Mary Jo Heath. Commentator Ira Siff is here with me. And the third and final act of Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor is coming up. It opens at the ruined tower of Wolf's Crag, Edgardo's ancestral home, where he has come after the devastating confrontation at Lammermoor Castle. It's storming outside, but Enrico has followed Edgardo here and now taunts him with the knowledge that Lucia is with her husband in their marriage bed. He demands satisfaction for Edgardo's insult to their family honor, and the two men resolve to duel the following morning at Ravenswood Cemetery.
You know, this entire scene used to be cut in order to get to the much-anticipated mad scene sooner, but it's powerful music with a strong dramatic purpose, and it explains why Enrico is not at his sister's wedding party in the upcoming scene.
Yes, the party's in full swing as the next scene opens, the guests celebrating the wedding, when suddenly Raimondo interrupts them, reeling from a horrifying discovery. Lucia, having lost her mind, has stabbed her new husband to death. To everyone's terror, she now appears in the hall, still wielding the knife, her wedding gown covered with blood.
And she descends the long staircase. It's such an iconic moment. You know, bel canto mad scenes often had a somewhat looser structure than bel canto arias, but Donizetti took this one to a whole other level. The music just flowing, a free-flowing train of thought from Lucia's imagination.
Yeah, she believes she's escaped from her family to be with Edgardo.
And we'll hear that love duet leitmotif as she imagines she's with him by the fountain.
But then she sees that ghost again, only now rising up to separate them. She recovers quickly from her terror, though, and imagines herself marrying Edgardo. She pictures it in great detail, the incense, the candles, the minister.
That melody Lucia sings as she says, "Al fin son tua," I am finally yours, you're finally mine. It's so moving. It's heartbreaking because she's so happy, and we know it's only a delusion. The glass harmonica seems to be playing music that only she can hear.
And it continues with her into the extended, interpolated cadenza we were talking about. When her brother returns, he's shocked to see her in this condition. As he realizes that it's his own fault, he's overcome with remorse. But it's too late. Lucia already feels death approaching, and she welcomes it.
And in her gentle cabaletta, trills and scales evoke her ascent from the world as she says that heaven will not be beautiful for her until Edgardo joins her there.
And as the scene ends, Lucia collapses. The opera's final scene finds Edgardo, too, welcoming the idea of death. He's at his ancestral graveyard, awaiting his duel with Enrico. Seeing the castle all lit up, he believes Lucia is celebrating with her new bridegroom.
After this tormented recitative comes his extraordinary double aria. In the plaintive first aria, Edgardo pictures his own grave, which he imagines will be uncared for.
And he forbids Lucia from coming there, saying, "At least respect the ashes of one who dies for you." But then he encounters mourners who have come from the castle. From them he learns about Lucia's grief and madness, and Raimondo informs him that she has died. And now Edgardo understands that she never betrayed him.
And in his second aria, this is one of Donizetti's most touching, with a gorgeous long-lined melody, "Since tu che a Dio spiegasti l'ali, you who have flown to God."
Edgardo, longing to be with Lucia in heaven, stabs himself.
He sings the second verse of the aria with broken phrases, a mournful cello solo filling in the missing fragments of the melody as he grows weaker.
And in our production, we see the ghost of Lucia cradling him lovingly as he dies. In this final act, we'll hear, in order of vocal appearance, Vittorio Grigolo as Edgardo, Massimo Cavalletti as Enrico, Vitali Kovalyov as Raimondo, and Olga Peretiatko-Mariotti as Lucia. The verifone is played by Friedrich Heinrich Kern. Gareth Morell is conducting the Met, chorus, and orchestra. The set for the Wolf's Crag is spare, with just a few bits of furniture on stage. And then the wall rises to reveal the set for the mad scene. Giant curved wooden staircase leads up to a high walkway that stretches across the stage. Here's Gareth Morell. Let's hear the third and final act of Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor.
Thank you. sconvolto, sia l'ordin di natura e per almo. Arresta, chi va nella tempesta, tra le minacce e l'ira, chi può avvenirne? Io, quale ardire? Ashton, tra queste mura osi offrirti al mio cospetto.
Io mi sto per tua sciagura.
Per mia
non venisti nel mio tetto.
L'ombra è dolce e forte frema, morto di amore te qui inspira, il terren per te qui trema, nel varcar la scoglia rema, quando cresci palpitar, come non te di voce. Come l'uom che vivo scenda, la sua tomba d'albergar, albergar, la sua tomba.
Che squarcia
il cor ferito, o tormento, o gelosia,
e alla tala
amore, o gelosia. Ebbene,
ascolta, letizia al mio soggiorno e di plausi rimbombava, ma più forte al cuor mi ritorno, la vendetta mi parlava, qui mi trassi in mezzo ai venti, la sua voce udia tuttor, e il furor degli elementi rispondeva. Rispondeva il mio furor,
ciò che al paterno c'è. parte il cuore. Sì, quando al primo sorgere del mattutino albore.
Preparati, vivi, tu ucciderai. Yeah. Thank you. felice.
Rispetta almeno le ceneri di chi moria
Thank you. è decisa la mia sorte. Rivederla, compagnia. Sì, vederla. Ah!
unable to be with his beloved Lucia in this world, Edgardo has killed himself in order to join her in heaven. That was the conclusion of Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor, coming to you live from the stage of the Metropolitan Opera House here in New York City. And now the lights are back up on our show curtain, which has all these bare trees, and director Mary Zimmerman said it was kind of exposed nerve endings to her. Looked like Scotland, bare Scotland, and poor Lucia's unsteady or frazzled state.
And the Gothic feel of the production.
Yes, indeed. And now our curtain is going up. And here's our Normanno, Gregory Schmidt, tenor from Wisconsin. Deborah Nansteel, Aliza, mezzo-soprano from North Carolina. This is her Metropolitan Opera debut role and season. And here is Mario Chang, tenor from Guatemala, our Arturo, his fourth Met role. He was in the Lindemann Young Artist Development Program here at the Met. Here's Vitaly Kovalyov, our Raimondo, based from Kiev in the Ukraine. Made his debut here in 2003, his 14th role. He'll be back in Aida as Ramfis next season and in Yolanta. Here's Massimo Cavalletti, our Enrico, baritone from Lucca, Italy. His fifth Met role, we've heard him as Marcello, Schaunard, Escamillo, and Lescaut from Puccini. Here's Vittorio Grigolo. Italian tenor, born in Arezzo, grew up in Rome. His third role at the Met this season, Hoffmann, Cavaradossi, and Tosca, and now Edgardo is down on one knee with his hand flat on the Met stage, arms outspread to the audience, and throwing his heart out to the audience as he usually does, blowing a big kiss. He'll be back next season as Rodolfo in La Boheme and as the Duke in Rigoletto. And now Vittorio is clapping, as are the fellow cast members, for our Lucia, Olga Petitiaca Mariotti. Oh, she looks a little bit taken aback by all the applause. And here come flowers. Oh, my gosh. One, two, three, four bouquets. Soprano from St. Petersburg, Russia. We've heard her as Gilda, as Elvira and Violetta. A big kiss and thanks to the orchestra down below, applauding everybody. And now she's walking over to acknowledge our Verifone player, Friedrich Heinrich Herren, and they're shaking hands. Very nice. Blowing a big kiss to the audience. She's going to be singing Layla in Pearlfishers in Berlin on Friday, so she better be getting on a plane pretty soon, I think.
Taxi.
Taxi. That's good, Ira. And now the entire cast is holding hands and bowing together. Everybody, now they're backing up. And she's going to go fetch our conductor, and she's like doing jazz hands at Gareth Morrell. Our conductor today, he made his debut at the Met in 1989, leading this very opera. He's led seven operas at the Met, including this season, this one, Semiramide and Tosca. He's a British composer. He's an assistant conductor on the Met's music staff. Very valuable guy to have around.
Indeed.
And now everyone's bowing together. One more time, run forward, gang. Deep bow from them all. And here come Vittorio Grigolo and Olga Petitiaca Mariotti. Big hug between them. Blowing a kiss, and now they're going to go to the other side of the stage. Olga told us that they had sung together one time before, back when she was a young artist in Hamburg. Mm-hmm. He was the Duke in Rigoletto, and she was the page. And what was the line?
Oh, yes. Well, look, she says to the courtiers that the Duchess would like to see the Duke, and they go, he's out hunting.
And that was it. That's
and
her whole part.
She says, without his weapons, without his retinue, that's the whole part.
That's the whole part. Okay. One more bow. Let's all rush forward. So things have changed. Now she's Lucia and he's Edgardo. How about that? 13 years later. All righty, and now the curtain is going down. Big wave as it goes down. I like this. Curtain goes down and they're all squatting down, getting the last waves in. The music producer for this Metropolitan Opera broadcast is J. David Sachs, and the operations director is John Kurzweil. Ed Hartley, Robert Hewitt, and David Bullard are the broadcast engineers, and for the quiz, Rob Gorton. Our senior radio producer and editor is Ellen Keel. The show producer is John Bischoff. The producer is William Berger, and the associate producer is Lee Ellen Vem. We had production assistance from Yolanda Williams, Michael Griebel, and Geza Kudlak. The broadcast stage manager is Lori Squire. The executive producers are Mia Bongiovanni and Elena Park. The Metropolitan Opera's music director designate is Yannick Nezet-Séguin, and the general manager is Peter Gelb.